Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hello and welcome to Policy Forum Pod, the podcast for all those who want to dig a little deeper into the policy challenges facing Australia and its region. I'm Martin Pierce. Policy Forum Pod is produced by policyforum.net, based at Crawford School of Public Policy, Asian Pacific's leading graduate policy school. And if you have plans to take up a policy-facing role in the future, then we highly recommend you check out our degrees and short courses at crawford.anu.edu.au/study. Now, the last few weeks haven't been easy on any of us. Like many of our listeners, I'm working from home at the moment, and I am recording this episode in accordance with social distancing rules from my home office. From the outset, I want to say that we at Policy Forum are committed to continuing all of our podcasts, though like everyone, we've had to be flexible. We'll be recording remotely. We're doing everything we can to ensure our sound quality is as high as possible, but please do bear with us. For example, to improve the sound quality, to paint you a bit of a visual picture, today I have pulled a giant blanket over my head, so that's where I am right now. I'm under a blanket with my microphone and my computer to record another episode of Policy Forum Pod to hopefully keep you informed during what is a very difficult time. Now, whilst the number of COVID-19 infections or deaths in Australia haven't yet reached the grim heights that we see in some of the worst affected countries, everyone is starting to feel the toll of the coronavirus. Public life has ground to a halt, many people have lost their jobs, and anxiety about what lies ahead is high. The social outlets many of us relied on have been necessarily curtailed, and we're facing a 24-hour news cycle that can make it really difficult to switch off. All of this can take an enormous toll on our mental health. At the beginning of this week, Dr. John Allen, the president of the Royal Australian and New Zealand College of Psychiatrists, said that there are the psychological impacts of public health measures to contain the virus, which can exacerbate pre-existing anxiety and other mental health conditions and can lead to increases in distress, symptoms, and relapse into mental health. So today on the podcast, we want to ask, what can policymakers do to ease the impact of COVID-19's flow-on effects on people's mental health? And in the spirit of social distancing, we've moved our recordings online, and the two experts that I'm talking to today are joining us remotely from the safety of their own homes. First is Dr. Sebastian Rosenberg. He's been on the pod before, of course. He was the head of the Mental Health Policy Unit at the ANU Centre for Mental Health Research. And with him is Professor Luis Salvador Carulla, who is the head of the Centre for Mental Health Research here at the ANU, and he was previously an advisor to the Government of Catalonia in Spain, the Spanish Ministry of Health, the European Commission, and the World Health Organization. So welcome, Sebastian and Luis. It's great to have you with us today. So hello, Sebastian.
Good afternoon.
And hello, Luis.
Hello, how are you doing?
Very well. Now, before we get into the discussion, let me start by asking, how are you both doing? Are you working entirely from home at the moment?
Well, at ANU, those above 60 years old were requested to work from home last Friday. So I've been self-isolation with my wife and working from home since then.
And what about you, Sebastian?
And I'm not quite 60, I'm only 53. So theoretically, I could have gone into ANU to do work, I think, until today, when notification came that they that the university would really prefer to have people working remotely. So I have been working remotely for a little while, and I can perhaps explain my tale of woe to you later, or maybe over a beer.
And of course, thousands of us Australians are now working from home, and some have even been forced to self-isolate for multiple weeks. Lewis, let me ask you, what is COVID-19 doing to our sort of collective mental health?
I think it's going to have a very significant impact. And something that is critical is just understanding and analyzing what is happening in other countries. I am working closely with Italian and Spanish colleagues and colleagues all over Europe, and you can see to what extent the impact of COVID in mental health is going to be very significant.
Now, what about the mental health of vulnerable groups? I mean, how is this crisis affecting those? Perhaps I could put that to you, Sebastian.
Sure. So, look, I think the first thing to say is that the mental health system in Australia has been reviewed many times by many separate statutory inquiries. I think there were 32 separate inquiries between 2006 and 2012 alone. And what these statutory inquiries generally find is that the mental health system is in crisis. And in that respect, what they generally find is that people have difficulty getting access to any care, and then they often have difficulty getting access to care if they don't live in a city. And they also have difficulty finding access to quality care. So the word which is generally used in these inquiries to describe mental health in Australia is that we are in a crisis. Now, this is the environment in which COVID-19 arrives. So it is not a robust foundation. It is a system which could be characterised largely as broken. So what that means is that you already find particular groups in the community, or many groups in the community, not necessarily just vulnerable groups, but many groups are struggling to get access to affordable, equitable, quality mental health care already. So we know that mental health care and the need for mental health services mirrors to a large extent the economic situation facing the country. We know that there have been peaks before during the Great Depression and so on, and we know that this relates not just to mental illness but also to issues like suicidality, and clearly this is going to be an issue that we're going to face. So groups that and people who are already vulnerable already find it difficult to find good care, and now we're going to have new groups of people, some of whom are rightly, justifiably, just anxious about COVID, and others that will have material concerns based on the fact that they are newly unemployed, that they are facing mortgage stress, housing pressure, and so on, that will need to be cared for in a variety of ways. And to be fair, I think Prime Minister Scott Morrison started to allude to that in some of his recent discussions, where he was really talking about the need for us to look after not just the economic health and the physical health, but also the mental health of the population.
So, I mean, it sounds to me like you're saying there, Sebastian, we went into this in crisis mode when it comes to mental health, and now we've got a very serious public health crisis on top of that. How do policymakers, how do the government go about getting enough capacity to deal with the sort of increased number of people that are going to be needing support?
I've been trying to reflect on this a little bit because it's not an easy question to answer. What I would say is I think that there is a real limit to the extent to which we can use or just expand existing structures. So, for example, I think the idea about shifting to permit telehealth is welcome and very sensible. However, I really am afraid that the level of need in the community is going to be beyond the capacity of our workforce and our service system as they are currently structured to meet the level of demand. And so I think now is the time for us to really start to think in a enduring way and in a significant way about what it is we need to do to create new ways of getting access to care. So here we start talking not just about access to clinical services in a face-to-face way, but also about access to technologies. We also need to be thinking about really emphasising for the first time in Australia, I submit, what is the role of psychosocial services and support? So not just thinking about health professionals and medications, but in fact thinking about this more holistically. And that's the first time this has really been done, despite the fact that this has been called for many years in Australia in mental health. In fact, our service system has relied very much on medications and health professionals. And those two answers alone were inadequate, and they'll be even more inadequate now.
Lewis, I wonder if I could turn to you and get your perspective on what this issue looks like internationally. Obviously, public health professionals all around the world are scrambling to deal with the COVID crisis. They're scrambling to get public messaging out there. They're scrambling to make sure that their health services are up to scratch. Are policymakers and politicians and, you know, international bodies like the WHO thinking enough about mental health aspects of this crisis?
I think that there are major developments going on around the world. I may say that one of the major contributions in this area has been what is called the Interagency Standing Committee that has released guidelines for mental health support in crisis, and they are very good. They provide a whole analysis of the different fears, the problems of stigma, aspects of how to improve coordination of care, analysis of existing services, and planning strategies. One of the aspects that is very important is the need to properly assess the capacity of the system to provide care. And we've been working at the Center for Mental Health Policy at the Visual and Decision Analytics Lab on the analysis of precisely what is the capacity of the system in several countries, including Australia, from the point of view of availability of services, capacity of these services to provide care, what is the number of beds, the number of places, and also looking at the number of full-time equivalents of professionals, not by services, but by clinical units that are providing that type of care. And now we are able to model what is the impact of anything happening in the context of care on the capacity of the system. This type of information is critical. One of the problems we have had internationally is that most of the models that were looking at the COVID-19 were just based on morbidity and mortality data. And they were not taking into account the capacity of the context of the system to provide the proper care. And it's when you combine morbidity, the number of cases, the incidence, the number of new cases, and the rates of mortality related to COVID with the capacity of the system, and you incorporate the fact that you should take into account also the number of infections in health staff, when you really start to provide models that are useful for planning, which is the critical thing now, how we plan our resources in the next weeks in the most efficient way.
And do you think that policymakers are considering those aspects that you talked about, or are they just too busy scrambling to find answers to the sort of unfolding immediate public health crisis of making sure that there's enough beds and making sure that there's enough respirators?
Well, there was a piece in New York Times 1 week ago looking at the case of Italy and just trying to take lessons from the experience in Italy. And one of the things that is critical is what is the reaction of the policymakers, whether they are able to act decisively and quickly in front of the outbreak, the fact that the critical early days of the outbreak are essential. Any action that is taken early when you have over 200 and for certain over 1,000 cases, it's critical. And one of the things that happened in Italy was a certain denial by some officers that were not providing the proper analysis of the risk that was involved in the COVID crisis. And there was at the New York Times piece a warning of how other governments beyond Italy were in danger of following the same path and repeating some familiar mistakes that we can now understand better. And one critical aspect there is avoid mixed messages, avoid confusion in the general population. And this is a pattern that unfortunately has been repeated in several countries.
Now, I want to turn from the sort of global outlook to a much more personal one. People will be experiencing this crisis through their TVs, through their news outlets, through social media, and there's this kind of constant drip of information, some of it conflicting, and constant updating of precautions and measures that people need to take in order to keep themselves safe. Sebastian, what role does this constant media exposure play in people's mental health?
Look, I think that's another great question. So, look, I was trying to think about this too. It seems to me as though, you know, good mental health is often expressed in two ways, I suppose, a sort of a sense of social connection, and often that's at work where you are productive and you're with your friends and colleagues and you're working and contributing, but it can be elsewhere, that sense of social connection, obviously with your friends, but also that sense of personal autonomy and being able to make decisions for yourself. And I guess the issue is that, you know, Corona affects both of these things. You know, it's been said that isolation is the enemy of good mental health. Well, Corona threatens us literally with isolation. And going to what Luis was saying, we have to acknowledge that, you know, messages about how to respond have been confused. On one hand, we're told this is a massive crisis, but on the other hand, don't go hoarding. You can have 10 people at a funeral, but 5 at a wedding. Universities should hold face-to-face classes. Should not hold face-to-face classes, but schools should. So, you know, it's a very difficult environment. I appreciate that people are making decisions quickly, but the kind of clear messaging to try to create a level of certainty is missing. And so this kind of uncertainty with the threat of isolation is a recipe for increased mental illness. So in my mind, you know, there's another kind of curve that we need to bend, and it's the curve of mental illness. We need to think about, you know, what's the hand washing we need to do to promote good mental health? And here I think we need to say, well, we've got to try to take opportunities to create that sense of personal agency, which goes back to the autonomy thing. You know, at a time when lots of decisions are being made for us, where can we go, when, who with, and so on, how do we create a new sense of personal agency and control? And here I think we need to be thinking also about opportunities to engage in social actions, things to do together. And people are already doing this online. You will have seen videos of people working together online, and technology now permits many of us to connect in new and effective ways. So I'm suggesting that, in fact, what we need to be thinking about are ways to permit and encourage social cohesion at a time when Corona is promoting isolation.
In addition to what you are saying, Sebastian, Lancet has published a fantastic systematic review, rapid review of the literature on pandemics. And this review has identified the major factors related to as stressors during a quarantine. And they say that one of them is the duration of the quarantine. Of course, this is going to be quite long. The others are the fears of infection, frustration and boredom, problems with supplies, and one that is critical is information. If there should be a balance between not alarming the general population and providing the proper information is better. So as far as the information is not confusing, it's very helpful to avoid a high level of stressors. Other two factors are the financing issues. And we have to be aware that we have two crises here. One is the pandemics and the other is the financial crisis. So this is a very important one. And finally, the other one is stigma. And this is an issue where we have the double stigma in people who may have mental problems, that will have problems in speaking to the norms, in providing the proper hygiene, etc., and the stigma related to COVID. Finally, this Lancet paper provides a series of solutions. One of them is to give people as much information as possible. The other one is to have a special focus on the health of healthcare workers. The other is supplies, provide adequate supplies. Other one is reduce boredom and increase communication. And I think that this provides a very good framework for understanding what is needed. The other aspect is the positive consequences of undergoing a crisis as this one. I think that Australia has embedded a very strong feeling of community. And this is important in situations like this. And it provides the capacity of altruism and cooperation that probably will be one of the things that we are going to see throughout the crisis.
Well, listeners, that sounds like a good place to take a quick breather, but we'll be back with you shortly to have a drill down a little more into some of the policy responses to the COVID-19 mental health challenge.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hi, I'm Mark Kenny. Each week on the Democracy Sausage Pod, we serve up fresh, meaty analysis of Australia's politics and policy and chew the fat with some of the country's leading experts. It's the podcast for those who like sizzling scrutiny with just a touch of sauce. You can find Democracy Sausage on iTunes, Spotify, or at policyforum.net/podcasts.
And welcome back. Thanks for sticking around. I'm still here with Dr. Sebastian Rosenberg and Professor Luis Salvador Carulla. So now I'd like to turn to some of those policy responses that we have seen to the mental health issues that are related to COVID-19. Sebastian, Australia is looking to have a whole of population telehealth capacity, as you mentioned, by March the 30th, which is going to include mental health, allied health and general practice. What does all of that mean? Will it work?
Well, so what it means is that people won't need to necessarily travel to see a health professional face-to-face. They'll be able to do so remotely and from where they live themselves, and that certainly makes things easier. We know that with Australia being a big country and with the maldistribution of our workforce, our mental health workforce and our health workforce more generally, it can be difficult for people to travel. And then on top of that, of course, you have restrictions about where people can travel. Some borders are closed. The advice generally is to stay put, not to go out. And so telehealth brings the healthcare system to you rather than having to go to it. And look, I think that this may well work to some extent in that it will create new levels of access, but it is emblematic of the fact that we have a very old-fashioned approach to the way we provide healthcare, and the way we do that, it very much suits the health professional. In that the people generally go along to the health professional in their rooms to see them. And in fact, what this does is, and what telehealth does is really challenge that as a modality. We actually have got to think about different ways of delivering care to people. So will it work? I think it will make a difference to people, but I think the nature of this crisis, its breadth, the fact that it will touch people's way of life, the way they interact, their economic circumstances, their personal circumstances, means that, again, we need a reaction that is beyond the role and remit of just health professionals. We need to be thinking about what others can contribute to that process. And here I'm talking about, again, psychosocial type support, a range of people who may not be health professionals per se, but may be able to assist people with the increasingly difficult tasks of daily living.
So are you talking there about communities sort of pulling together to support other members of the community?
I am indeed. And so, you know, as Lewis was saying, there is a great deal of altruism and volunteerism in Australia, that people are willing to chip in and help. And that's always seen, it was seen recently during the bushfires and so on. But the scale of this is beyond volunteering. And with so many people caught up in this dilemma, it's not really practical. You know, but we need to be thinking about the range of community organisations and others that are in a position to provide the types of support that can augment that provided by health professionals. And, you know, the system of community mental health support, including psychosocial support, has never been properly invested in. Now is the perfect time for us to be thinking about the resources that need to go not just to boosting our economy and ameliorating the impacts of COVID on our economy, but on ameliorating the impacts of COVID on our communities. And this is where these organisations can play a really significant role in a way they never have. They've never been permitted to in Australia.
We have seen some quite nice examples at a community level of sort of communities rallying around. I saw there's a great story from the UK about someone who sort of delivered little leaflets through everyone in their everyone's door in their street, saying if you're isolating or need some support, you know, here are my contact details and just tell me what you want to do, and sort of communities pulling together that way. Sebastian, have you seen any particular examples of either community members or community organizations, like you say, pulling together to plug those gaps?
Yes, no, there have been the similar sorts of examples already in Australia of people reaching out to neighbours, to isolated older people and so on. And this is the kind of thing which really needs to occur. But, you know, this is volunteerism, and it is possible for periods of time and so on. And I think that that's not unhelpful. But what we're talking about here is going to require a sustained and organised effort, not a it shouldn't be left to chance or luck. We should be looking, in the same way Lewis is talking about, a systematic approach to planning an organised response to the mental health needs of people. We need to be thinking about the similar kind of response to, if you like, the community needs of people. And at the moment, this has never been part of the way we've approached mental health in any serious way in Australia. And COVID, if it provides anything, provides an opportunity for us to recalibrate around that effort.
Luis, I'd like to turn to you to ask a question about language. The World Health Organization has published some guidelines around the language related to COVID-19. They're asking people not to refer to people with the disease as COVID-19 cases or victims or the diseased to reduce stigma. What are your thoughts on that?
Language is so important. And I think the recommendations made by WHO are really important. We have very basic examples. We are talking about social distance. And really what it is physical distance. We are just framing the things in sometimes in not the best way. But I would like to add in relation to the previous Sebastian's comments that something that you can learn from other places of what is the role of mental health and psychiatry in particular is the huge effort that has happened both in Italy and Spain in providing e-health and digital counseling. And there's something that is very important in Australia is the high development of digital technologies in mental health. We have some of the best platforms in the world. Unfortunately, some of these platforms are IP protected and you have to access them. They are restricted. They have restricted access. I think that this would be a very good opportunity to try to release one or two platforms that are providing support, guidance, checklist and diagnosis or cognitive behavioral therapy in a way that they could be used by the population in this moment of crisis. In addition to that, this platform can allow psychologists and psychiatrists to support the general population and even allow retired professionals to engage in this major effort that's highly needed by our society.
Yeah, can I just come in there too, if I may? I just want to fully back Luis's comments. I think that Australia has been a world leader in the establishment of these kinds of digital platforms. And it is remarkable to me that they have not penetrated Australia's mental health service system as much as they could have. And as I say, it's not just a matter of people being able to access these kinds of services for health professional support. I think that there is a real role to link these digital platforms to a broader appreciation, a broader response to what it means to have mental health problems. So we're not just talking about managing clinical conditions, or we're not even talking about managing clinical conditions, we're talking about addressing a person's needs more holistically. And again, these platforms offer that kind of opportunity.
Now, before we finish this discussion, I'd like to pick your brains on two more things, one which is about policymakers and one which is more about individuals. So firstly, if I can put this to you, Sebastian, to start, if policymakers want to effectively relieve the mental health burden that COVID-19 is posing and is going to pose, where's the best place to start?
So I think the digital area is the way to begin. I should say that I really feel as though we need to be, often when we're talking about mental health and responding to mental illness, it becomes a very unhelpful blancmange because you start talking about it in very general terms. And so I think it's useful for us to try to segment the nature of the problem we are attempting to address. So there would be many people, justifiably, as I said at the beginning, who would be newly anxious about the circumstances in the world, the circumstances facing their family and so on. So there is a need to address a level of anxiety, new anxiety in the community. And this is, if you like, mental health promotion and early intervention. And then there is also a need for people who will be finding themselves facing new significant mental health problems that are associated with longer periods of hopelessness, helplessness, depression because of things like financial stress or unemployment and so on. And again, the answers to how we address these things should be would be helpfully segmented so that we were trying to address or tailor solutions to meet the needs of groups usefully. But I think particularly in an environment where people are not being encouraged to travel, not to go out, then I think we have the natural place to look is to build on Australia's world leadership in the establishment of digital platforms for mental health care. I think this could be done quite quickly, and it would begin by these platforms providing a clear source of consistent messages, because that is the wellspring from which people get a sense of autonomy and control.
And Lewis, what about you? If you were advising the Prime Minister Scott Morrison, he said, "I want to do something, you know, to tackle the mental health burden that's expected from COVID-19." What would you say to him? Where would you say that he would be best placed to start? Would it be those digital platforms that Sebastian talked about there?
Yes, I think that understanding what is the workforce capacity. Understanding the size of the problem that we will have in the coming weeks and providing a proper alternative, that it should be digital. There is no other way out. And just also taking into account the capacity of the system to provide care under these circumstances. Those are the critical things. It's not that much. What is the size of the morbidity, the new cases of the problem, is understanding the capacity of our system, including the digital health system, to provide appropriate care in a very critical condition.
So there's just one other thing I wanted to mention, if I could. You know, I'm trying to think about placing this unprecedented event in some perspective, and I guess as a sort of a ray of hope, if you like. Obviously, Christchurch was hit by a terrible earthquake in February 2011, I think, and you know the rate of access to mental health care was significantly affected by that event, but maybe not in the way you think. Now, the rate of access to care, in fact, increased, and that's because old ways of working, which were based on appointments and consultation rooms and shows and no shows and so on, were redundant. Now, health professionals met their clients in parks. They met wherever they could that was safe. You know, we need to be thinking about different ways of working, different ways of delivery that understand the scale of the problem and respond in a different way. We can't expect our existing workforce to operate harder, more, faster, quicker. That response will be inadequate. So I think there are lessons elsewhere that we can draw on.
Yeah, there is another thing, sorry to interrupt you, Sebastian. I was in Christchurch during the aftermath of the earthquake, and one of the things that's very interesting is their commitment to improve mental health care and care for the fragile, for the disabilities after the earthquake. There was a major development of services, of programs after this period. And that is another opportunity just to think, as you started by saying that we are in a crisis of mental health. We are now on a crisis on the top of another crisis. And there is a window of opportunity to really think in the service provision, in the way we have to face that and find better alternatives as the ones we have now.
Well, let's finish this off by bringing it from a policy level down to a personal level. Could I get you both to give us your three top tips on how individuals can best cope with the mental health impacts of COVID-19? Perhaps, Lewis, if I start with you.
Well, the first one is keep active. active psychologically and physically. Engage with your family and learn how do you live your family life in a very different way, very closely to each other. The other is support your community in the best way you can. I think these three things are the critical ones that we have to develop during the crisis.
Wonderful. And what about you, Sebastian? What are your three top tips?
I think I would largely mirror what Lewis was saying. I think you need to find ways to retain a sense of social connection at a time of isolation. Because, you know, while this may be a time of isolation, it is no time to feel alone. And I guess we're lucky in many ways that we have the capacity to stay connected to one another. I think one of the other things that the government could be doing is to help people enable themselves to take actions. So, again, this is about assisting people to achieve that sense of personal autonomy. And whether that is doing the things that Luis said or other things, it's about making it as boosting the sense that at a time when many of us feel as though we're not in control, we do have some level of control as well as some level of social connection. And I think that's what's really critical.
Sebastian, apart from what you said, I'm thinking about what can I advise the government is to be in touch with experts in logistics. We need logistics. We already know quite a lot about the epidemiology, and it has happened in other countries, that you end up by having a major weight of epidemiologists providing advice. It's critical to have good people in logistics. And the other thing is we decided, my wife and I, to call a friend every day. So we are just going through our whole phone listing and calling one person a day just to talk to him or her and know how they are doing.
But you haven't called me yet. You haven't called me yet. Maybe I'm under. I'm under R for Rosenberg. So that's a long way down.
Well, look, I think that sounds like excellent advice to pick up the phone and to talk to your friends. I mean, part of the problem is that we talk about social isolation. Perhaps we should be talking about spatial isolation, because we really want to make sure that we maintain that social contact with our friends and with our family, even despite everything that's going on. So thank you so much to both of you for joining us today on a really important topic unfolding in this crisis. So many thanks, Sebastian.
Thank you very much.
Many thanks, Lewis.
Thank you.
Listeners, if you want to let us know what you thought of the discussion or share your ideas for future podcasts with us, please reach out. We're on Twitter at APPS Policy Forum, that's Apps Policy Forum, or send us an email, podcast@policyforum.net. And as we've just heard on the podcast, staying together and having a community to support one another is now more crucial than ever, which is why we'd like to invite you to join our community. You can find us on Facebook as Policy Forum Pod. It's a great space to have conversations with the other listeners and with our presenters, and you'll also have the exclusive opportunity to listen to our Ask Policy Forum podcast, where you get to ask us all the questions. I hope you have got something out of today's episode. And if you did, please don't forget to subscribe. It's super easy to find us. We're on Acast, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your favorite pods from. And whilst you're on it, you might also want to leave us a review. And if you or anyone you know are struggling, you can contact Lifeline or Beyond Blue. Links and phone numbers for both organisations are in the show notes. And we've also included links to a couple of specific resources related to looking after your mental health during the COVID-19 pandemic. We'll be back next week with another episode of Policy Forum Pod. But until then, from me, Martin Pierce, take care of yourself, take care of each other, and cheerio for now.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.